Good morning. On this 10th anniversary of the horrific acts that happened at the World Trade Center and in other parts of the country, we thought it would be appropriate, at least for the first part, to have, I consider, three heroes from 9/11, three individuals who were able to merge the tradition of halacha and of philosophy to minimize and in some ways to defy the evil that was perpetrated in 9/11. And I'll introduce our panelists in a few minutes, but we also thought it would be appropriate to begin this morning with the Kefilta Tehillim, asking the Kadosh Baruch Hu to continue to heal all those families that continue to go through the challenges that began in 9/11. And then a prayer for the United States and a prayer for Medina Israel. So if I could ask everyone to please rise. We're going to recite Tehillim Kuf Chavaleh, Shir HaMaaleh Sinai Ha'orim. We'll recite it responsibly. Shir HaMaaleh Sinai Ha'orim, Me'ayin Yavo Ezri. Adonai Yosei Shemayim Vaharez Al Yitek Mamot Reglecha Al Yonum Shomrecha Hinei La Yonum La Yishan Shomer Yisrael Adonai Shomrecha Adonai Silva Yahiminecha Adonai Shemecha Yahai Silva Yahiminecha Yomam Hashemesh Leyakeka V'yareyach Alayla
Yomam Hashemesh Leyakeka
V'yareyach Alayla Adonai Yishmorcha Mikora Yishmor Es Nafshecha Adonai Yishmor Tzeisva Bo'echa Me'ata V'yadolam Prayer for the welfare of the United States government and obtain Shu'al Amalchim U'memshalan Nesichim Ahusom Ahus Chalomim Apotes David Abdo Mecherev Ra'ah Hanusein Bayam Derech Umbamayim Azim Tziva Yivarechus Nasibesh Mishneyu Veskosarev Yosaelu Nalach Malchem Lachem Barachamavi Chayim Yishmarim Mikotzer Biyadu Menefik Azilein Biyitim Belivam Bulev Ko Yoatzeyam Sarayam Lasos Tavos Imanu Yimko Yisrael Achenu Yemehem Uyamenu Tibashay Yudah Yisrael Yishkan Vavetha Uvalitziyam Goel Vachini Yiratzam Benomar Amen.
Amen.
Abinu Shabbat Shemayim, Tzvi Yisrael, V'Golo, V'Reich, V'Medina Yisrael, Rishitz, V'Chaz, V'Latinu, Hagen Allah, V'Abras, L'Sadecha, V'Frosu, L'Sukash, L'Mecha, V'Shlach, Orocha, V'Mishlo, V'Rashya, T'Arra, V'Yotzeh, V'Sakneh, V'Eitzah, T'Ovo, M'Chanecha, Chazeh, Yishideh, V'Gineh, R'Tzachenu, V'An Kirein, V'Lehini, Yishua, V'Chet, T'Sachon, T'Atrein, V'Nesach, Shalom, V'Aretz, V'Simcha, Salam, V'Yoshveha. V'Yasachenu, Kobes Yisrael, V'Kadna, V'Chazos, V'Zurihem, Soliheim Mehirah, Kamina Sassini Rafa, Vishlamish Kanchimacha, Takasu, the source of Shevdecha, Imien, the Haku Pitash Mayim, Vishamika Vetsha, the Nel Hafa, Vishamika Hafa, Vadi Yafana, the Hafa, or Arata Shir Yeshua, the Sefer Mishta, a Tibcha, the Hir Kamel, the Sefer. Yahay, the Lavena, La, all Yerosh Mefa, Lishmor is called the Grace of Sefer, Vishlafa, the Mehirah, and Dabi Mishet, Sekha, with those who have engaged to a Sefer. Vofar, by Darman, Uzefa, הכל יש ועשר בארצך, ויאמר כל השני שמר ביפו, אדני אלוהי ישראל מלך, ומחוסו בכל משלה, אמן יצא לך.
אמן.
As I mentioned earlier this morning, we have the opportunity to begin the first hour of the Kol Medreshet Yom Rishon with hearing from individuals who contributed greatly to help minimize and defy the evil that was perpetrated in 9/11. And I'm going to introduce them in alphabetical order. First, Anat Barber. Anat is currently the planning executive in the Commission on Jewish People at UJA Federation New York, where she specializes in lay leadership development and integration of Ethiopian Israelis into Israeli society and creating connections between Jewish communities around the world. Anat is a graduate of Stern College, where she majored in philosophy and served as Stern Student Council President. After that, she was a presidential fellow. She went on to receive a master's in public administration from the Robert F. Wagner School of Public Service and a master's degree in Hebrew Judaic Studies from NYU simultaneously. She's one of these underachievers. And at the same time, participated as a Wexner graduate in the Wexner Graduate Fellowship Program. She resides in Riverdale with her husband, Rabbi Avi Bloom, also a Yeshiva University graduate, YCO2 at Reeds in Australia, another underachiever. And for today, most importantly, Anat was part of a large group of Stern College women who performed the great mitzvah of the Chetzel MS, of being Shomrim, of both with the men from Yeshiva College and from Stern College together, that served to be in charge of making sure that there were the last appropriate rights and dignity given to those who were murdered at Ground Zero. The next two rabbinic personalities, that we will have the opportunity to hear from are two men of great stature, particularly for today, were involved in resolving many of the Agunot issues, the majority of the Agunot issues that happened due to the tragedy of September 11th. Rabbi Ries, a noted Torah scholar attorney, is the dean, the Max and Marion Grill dean of the Rabbi Isaac Ochanan Theological Seminary. Rabbi Ries went to two YUs, first to Yeshiva University, and then to a second YU known as Yale. He then served as director of the Beis Din of America from 1998 to 2008. And it was during that time that Rabbi Ries was involved in many important causes, but in two that in some ways both Rabbi Ries and Rabbi Willard worked on together. And that was that Rabbi Ries was one of the strong advocates for a document that Rabbi Willard helped to resurrect and develop, and that is the prenuptial agreement, as well as Rabbi Ries was involved in dealing with issues of Agunot. Then Aharon Chaviv, our Rebbe, Rabbi Willig. Rabbi Willig is the Rabbi Dr. Saul Roth Professor of Talmud and Contemporary Halacha at NYU. He has been a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University since 1973. And Rabbi Willig played a leadership role in helping to convene all of the Batei Din, not only in America, but in conversations with many of the Jewish courts throughout the world to make sure there was a certain uniformity on how to resolve the issues of Agunah from the 9/11 issue, to make sure that there was the capacity for us not to have Agunot that were only approved by one Beis Din and, God forbid, not approved by another. Rabbi Willig serves as the Morah D'Atra of Young Israel Riverdale, the Bronx. For so many of us, he is the rabbi's rabbi. Many of us turn to him for our questions and for direction. And Rabbi Willig still serves as the deputy Beis Din of the Beis Din of America. It is my pleasure to begin by calling on Rabbi Ries, followed by Rabbi Willig, and then by Anat. Rabbi Ries.
Speaking here from the speaking here. Speaking here.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Grander. Good morning. Shus, Rabbi Willig, other Rabbanim Chashuvim, fellow panelists. What occurred 10 years ago on 9/11 was an event that shook the world, and I think certainly shook our community forever. We were all in a fog in a daze. In the days after the horrible attack by the terrorists on the World Trade Center and Twin Towers. And it was only, I would say, about 3 or 4 days after the tragedy that the Beth Din of America, where I worked at the time as the director of the Beth Din, was approached with a question that given that there were men who had perished, or presumed to have perished, in the tragedy that day, had we given any thought to the investigation of the necessary data in order to be able to issue psakim, to issue halakhic rulings, should the need arise, on behalf of women who would have lost their husbands in the tragedy so that they would not be agunot. And this hit us like a thunderbolt, because we were accustomed to going around and speaking about how, while the classical case, which is recorded in the Talmud, of an aguna, is the case of the missing husband, the man who goes off to sea and the boat sinks into the sea and the remains are not found and nobody can provide clear identification that the person had died. And the Gemara talks about how we lax normal rules of evidence according to halacha. While normally two witnesses are required to testify that a person was seen to have died, here even one witness is sufficient. We rely upon seeing that a person went into an area where they could not possibly have survived, what we call Mayim Sheyesh Lahem Sof, where they go into an area that if you see them sink, and the area is bounded with clear boundaries, and you didn't see them emerge anywhere, then you know for a fact that you can testify that the person has died. And we would always issue a caveat that yes, the Talmudic precedent of aguna is referring to a happy marriage, where a woman loses her husband due to tragic circumstances, and we have to figure out some way to demonstrate through evidentiary rules that the husband has perished, that the wife will be able to move on with her life. Normally nowadays, when we speak about aguna, that's not what we're talking about. The contemporary case of aguna, as you all know, is the case of the recalcitrant spouse, generally the recalcitrant husband, who refuses to give his wife a get, and therefore, since she is trained in an unhappy marriage, she ends up being an aguna for that reason. And this became part of our normal refrain at the Beth Din of America. We should also recognize parenthetically that the president of the Beth Din of America is here with us today, Ricky Goldstein. And yet, suddenly, and without any type of preparation or anticipation whatsoever, we found that we were actually confronted with a classical case of aguna, which is described in the Talmud, of the cases of husbands who are in a terrible tragedy where their remains cannot be identified. And very quickly, we realized that as the foremost Beit Din in the United States dealing with these types of issues, dealing with aguna issues, certainly, that it would be expected and it would be appropriate for us to assume the responsibility of dealing with any cases that might arise. And shortly after the tragedy, the Rabbinical Council of America and the Orthodox Union issued a statement to various communities in which they announced that if there were any cases that existed in those communities of husbands who had worked in the World Trade Center and were presumed to have perished, they should feel welcome to turn to the Beth Din of America for a resolution of any and all halakhic issues that might arise. And in the following weeks, we received inquiries and we received applications from at least 9 different widows who had lost their husbands in the World Trade Center and a man who had lost his wife in the World Trade Center. All told, the Beth Din of America dealt with 10 different cases of aguna arising from the World Trade Center tragedy, and we quickly went about the task of working with every single person, agency, and entity out there to compile the necessary data, to compile the necessary testimony and evidence so that we would be able to make the requisite halakhic determinations. And one question that I've been asked to address, at least for purposes of the panel discussion this morning, is whether there were any new policies that were initiated by the Beth Din of America in the course of its inquiry, in the course of this investigation. So one answer to that question is that we didn't initiate, but we had to once again bring out classical halakhic sources and terminologies and methodologies that were not generally utilized nowadays by the Besdin. We had to open up our Gemara in Yevamos, which the yeshiva here is learning this year, the very end of Maseches Yevamos, where the Gemara talks about what type of evidence is considered to be sufficient, and we had to study those sugyas, and we had to relearn all of those different halakhos. And this is, if you look at the literature, the halakhic literature, there are volumes and volumes and volumes, greater than volumes, discussing practically any other halakhic issue when it comes to the analysis of how one resolves the aguna situations and questions that arise with missing husbands. And we had to delve into all of those texts and all of those sources with extreme care and detail. And in that vein, Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz, the Avestan of the Besdin of America, delved into the sources. Rabbi Willig, who's going to be speaking today as well, was very involved in this analysis. And we also consulted with many, many poskim throughout the world as the data came in and as the questions arose. And one classic paradigm, of course, that the Gemara talks about is a man who's seen falling into a kibshan aish, falling into a fiery furnace, where you can testify that the person has died because nobody survives a fiery furnace. And we realize that we had to make analogies and comparisons, because certainly all of the people who are trapped in the North Tower of the World Trade Center above the point of impact of the plane, which was at approximately the 92nd floor at 8:46 a.m. on that morning of September 11th, were trapped in smoldering bellows of smoke where there was no chance for them to go down any stairwell or elevator, because the area above the plane crash was completely severed from the area below the plane crash, where it was akin to the fiery furnace, where there was no way for them to survive without being incinerated or without falling, toppling 100 stories to certain death. And either of those scenarios would be the equivalent of what the Gemara referred to as Kibshan HaEsh. But we also had to initiate inquiries into how we would apply halakha to new technologies of identification. What does halakha have to say about when there's only a portion of a body that is identified, and that there's no way of being able to tell who it is, but there's a portion of a skull in which one would be able to remove dental remains of an individual and compare those dental remains with dental x-rays? Is that considered to be an ironclad form of evidence, what the Gemara refers to as a siman mufa, that one would be able to rely upon? And here there was some recent literature, unfortunately, that had been developed in connection with the identification of remains in Israeli terrorist attacks and other such incidents, where it could be determined that the margin of error was so low that that type of identification could be a siman mufuk. But unfortunately, in most cases, we weren't even so fortunate to have that high level of identification. And the question arose, what about when all that was found of a person's body would be fragments of skin or bone, and they would extract cells from that skin or bone of the person, of the body tissue, and from those cells would be able to make an identification through what is not visible to the naked eye, but only to the scientific eye, namely DNA analysis, where the coding of a person's cells could be compared to the remains of DNA identification that had been on the person's toothbrush or hair comb or an envelope that they had licked, and through the medical examiner's office making a DNA identification. Is that reliable according to halakha? And in a fascinating meeting, the Besdin of representatives of the Besdin of America got together with representatives in the Beit Din of Lakewood, New Jersey, and with experts from the New York City Medical Examiner's Office, and we met in a late night meeting in Congregation of Deret El in downtown New York, right near the Medical Examiner's Office. And we had for hours a long discussion in which we discussed with the scientists the
science and the technology of DNA analysis, and we considered from a halakhic perspective how that fits or doesn't fit with the classical halakhic sources, is something which is not visible to the naked eye, considered to be any form of identification that could be relied upon, is something which relies upon a coding which is found in many different locations within the cell of many different loci that have to be placed, put together, rather than looking in simply one location. Is that considered for halakhic purposes to be a siman mubah, to be an ironclad form of identification? And we wrestled over these issues, and as a result of having to grapple with this enormous and unfathomable tragedy, the poskim of the world, from Eretz Yisrael and here in New York, had to actually establish a groundbreaking and precedential approach with respect to what would be the status of DNA identification. And at the end of this process, there actually was a halakhic breakthrough, which now is part of our evolving halakhic tradition, based upon classical sources and applying them to new situations, that the preponderance of the poskim were able to come to the conclusion that even if all that you had was DNA analysis, was a DNA identification, since the margin of error is usually less than 1 in 1 trillion and 1 in 1 quadrillion, that this was a unique enough form of identification that really could be relied upon. But in the Beis Din of America, given the data that we compiled, and given all of the other forms of evidence, either direct or circumstantial, we never had to rely on DNA identification alone. There were always other forms of evidence that would demonstrate at least the probability of death that could be put together or joined together with the DNA identifications in the cases where those identifications were made. But the third and final form of what I would say were processes that became new to the Beis Din and that really enabled the Beis Din to grow and learn from this experience was perhaps the message that is exemplified in this past week's parsha. This past week's parsha, we read about the mitzvah of Yibum. If a man dies, leaving no children, he leaves a wife, and he has at least one brother, then the wife is considered to be linked to the brother-in-law, and she cannot marry anybody else unless the brother-in-law either marries her, what we call Yibum, or performs the process known as chalitza, in which the woman takes a shoe, special shoe, offered for brother-in-law's foot, and throws the shoe away, and there are also other parts of this procedure. And in the introduction of the passage in the Torah that talks about chalitza, the Torah says, "Yeshvu achim yachdav." Brothers are sitting together, a sense of togetherness. U'meisachad me'em, and one of them dies. U'vein ein lo, and he doesn't have a son. And it occurred to me that this perhaps was the most striking lesson from the experience that we had in dealing with and resolving many of the Aguna cases that came before us. We resolved ultimately all of the 10 cases that we had to deal with, that it was all about Ki Yeshvu Achim Yachdav. It was all about coming together as a community. Of what do you do? How do you address a tragedy when Umeisachad Mehem, when somebody dies? When there are individuals who are stricken with terrible tragedy, how do you address it? You address it together, by coming together, by having a halakhic framework, by providing some sort of context, according to halakha, for dealing with tragedy. And this is what we provided to the families of the victims, was a halakhic framework. It was clear to everybody that these men had perished. It was clear at the end of the day we were going to find that they had died. But there was a halakhic framework for doing it, for figuring out when does the velus begin, when does the mourning process begin, for figuring out if you find some remains of a body that are just fragments of skin or tissue, how do you properly bury them, for figuring out what is the process for issuing the final declaration of death that officially tells the wife that she's able to remarry, and for gathering evidence and data. And everybody helped out, whether it was the Rabbanim, members of the community, co-workers who worked for somebody, who spoke to the Beis Din and gave the information that the Beis Din needed to be able to compile evidence. City agencies who worked together with the Beis Din, that we were able to reach out to the broader community around us. We were able to reach out to the Port Authority's office to be able to get necessary records from them of when people went through the World Trade Center, generally speaking, through their swipe cards. We were able to get records from the New York City Transit Authority with respect to Metro card records of an individual who was not placed in the building that day, but we had a record of where he bought his Metro card and when he used his Metro card to go through the subway station on his way to work that day. We worked with the New York City Medical Examiner's Office whenever any form of identification was made, whether through dental x-rays, fingerprints, or through DNA analysis, and they ultimately gave us access to their records so that we would be able to satisfy ourselves in terms of the data that was compiled. And at one point, there was a newspaper article that was a very full-fledged investigative report in which the reporters took together all of the factual evidence that had been compiled about 9/11, and they put it all down in great excruciating detail, and we thought, wow, there are other people out there who might be able to give us some valuable information that will be able to assist our inquiry. And we met with these newspaper reporters, and they turned to us, myself and Rabbi Rapp, and they turned to us and they said, looking at all the data we had compiled, your data and your investigation is superior to ours. You have more information than anybody else out there in terms of everything that happened that day. And we realized that the halakhic process and our impetus to work with everybody and the cooperative spirit that everybody provided to us enabled us to have perhaps what was the most rigorous factual record of 9/11. And then we saw people rising to the occasion. We speak about this mitzvah of chalitza, a mitzvah that we're learning about in yeshiva this year, a mitzvah that we read about during this past parsha. We had two women whose husbands, in fact, didn't have any children, and in fact, who left brothers, who had to go through a chalitza procedure. And the Beis Din convened a ceremony on May 30th, 2002, which was the day in which the victims' families were brought to the site of the World Trade Center, what's referred to as Ground Zero. And after that ceremony, they came to the Beis Din of America offices on 7th Avenue and 27th Street. And recognized the current director of the Beis Din, Rabbi Weissman, who's here with us as well. And we performed chalitza ceremonies for the two women who needed those ceremonies that day. And I remember that day that one of the fellows who performed the chalitza ceremony was a boy who was just still a teenager and was still tremendously anguished and suffering from the loss of his newlywed brother, who had died shortly after marrying his wife and embarking upon a new and promising life together, and then was tragically taken from him and the family in 9/11. And it was very, very difficult. And it was an emotionally heart-wrenching procedure to see this boy. You have to get in front of 10 rabbis and have to go through the entire chalitza procedure. But it was something which he did for his sister-in-law, so she would be able to go on and build her life. It was everybody coming together in order to be able to provide whatever help or assistance was possible, even in emotionally trying situations. And last year, I had the privilege of being invited to a Sheva Bokos, and the Chassan took me aside as I entered the room, and he said, "You recognize me?" And I said, "Not particularly, remember." And he said, "I'm the boy who did that chalitza 10 years ago. Remember, I came to the Beis Din that day, and I went through this process, and you were there. And remember that experience. And now, I'm getting married. And I'm going to be able to build a life that I hope will be a successful one. And one that will give pride and joy to my family." And I realized, this is a message that we can all take from 9/11. A message of being able to find hope find the future after terrible loss. The families to be able to move on, the widows, the other members of the family, to honor the memories of those who perished, and to be able to honor the gift of life by making the most of it ourselves, in terms of always being there for each other, both in times of Rahman al-Islam, tragedy, and God willing in the future, only times of happiness.
I was asked to speak for a few moments to describe my immediate involvement with 9/11, personally or professionally. On Monday night, September 10th, 2001, I boarded a plane to the Holy Land, Eretz Yisrael, to attend the bris of my grandson, scheduled to take place on Wednesday morning, September 12th. The flight was uneventful. We landed in the airport in Eretz Yisrael. As we were standing around to try to get our luggage, all of a sudden I see a tremendous tumult. Everyone's talking and yelling and screaming. And I had no idea what it was about. And they overhear people at the World Trade Center was attacked and fell down. It was mind-boggling. I couldn't believe it. So I approached one of my rabbinical friends who was on the plane. I said, "What happened today? That's true." So my immediate knowledge of the event was not in real time, as it was all of you who were here in New York. It was somewhat delayed. And, you know, the show must go on. The bris took place as scheduled on Wednesday. And I was scheduled to return on Wednesday night. I went to Mr. Shear. So I had this Tuesday and Wednesday. I had a plane back, ticket back for Wednesday night. What are you kidding? There are no planes flying in the whole world. Okay, Thursday night. No, forget about it. Motzei Shabbos, they said, maybe you'll get on a plane. That Thursday night, I went to hear a shir in the Holy City, given by great Talmud Chacham Rav Moshe Shapiro, Shalita, who spoke about the event and perhaps did my second response about the impact on the community. It was time I will cite what he said. But I realized already, I'm not sure before or after Rabbi Reis, while far away, this is going to come to our business. So that Friday, I went to see the preeminent Torah sages of the world, Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, to ask him once, what do we do? We had absolutely no experience, as Rabbi Reis indicated, with these types of own issues. It was very helpful, and I said, of course, you have to gather much more information. That Shabbos I spent at my son's house in Ramat Beit Shemesh. I was asked to be the guest speaker of the Shabbos after Musaf. I remember the emotional conclusion of my drasha had to do with the Haftorah for that parsha. This was 2 days before Rosh Hashanah. It was Haftorah parsha Netzavim, the last of the parshas of Haftorahs of consolation. Motzei Shabbos, I had a ticket, still couldn't get on. At the Balabata, I'm getting worried. Monday night's Rosh Hashanah. They could do it at the rabbi, but I'm also the Baal Tefillah. Finally, I was able to get on a plane on Sunday, but there was another problem. That was Erev Rosh Hashanah, and it was a year of post-Shemitah. There was a Prusbul man. Prusbul. And I had arranged in advance, and was coming on Sunday afternoon, so I could meet with them. I just couldn't make it back on time. But fortunately, one of my neighbors is none other than Rabbi Reis. got on the phone with them and said, Rabbi Reis, I can't make it. You please come to the shul and help with the principals. If I'm not mistaken, I think I came in the middle, straight from the plane, to be able to take care of the people. So I was certainly involved in that sense, personally and professionally. I'll never forget that week that I spent in the Holy Land and returning, coming back from the plane, there was this gaping hole with smoke coming out. It was just eye-popping. And then I heard, just then after returning, because we didn't know exactly how many victims there were at that time. They numbered in the thousands. But you know, victims who are nameless and faceless, even if they number in the thousands, it makes a tremendous intellectual impact upon you. But the emotional impact is somehow numbed by a lack of identity. Upon my return, maybe even when I was in Eretz Israel, I don't remember when, it came to my attention that one of my own talmidim, my own beloved students, was among those who perished. When you have one student who you know, love, it makes a tremendous, tremendous impact. As a matter of fact, for many months, that particular case was the most difficult case that we had in our midst. Because as was indicated before, there was absolutely no evidence. He was even in the building at the time. And when I went back there to stroll on my annual trip on behalf of the yeshiva in January, this was the case that was gnawing me the most. We had no evidence that he ever entered the building. We knew only about his daily pattern, what he would do every single day. He would go to work, he had a certain route, he'd take a certain bus, a certain train. We had evidence of how long it would take. So by all probability, assuming he went on his daily route, he was unfortunately in the middle of the time. Could one rely upon such a pattern of behavior? And while in Eretz Yisrael, we discussed the subsequent shir called corresponding with the dawn of Eretz Yisrael, there was an ample precedent for this, unfortunately, cases in which, for example, an individual would have a daily pattern going to work and cross a certain bridge, and the bridge collapsed that day, and all those who were on the bridge perished. We didn't know he was on the bridge, only by virtue of the pattern of previous days. There's much to be said about this in the halakhic literature. 10 years later, we look back and say to ourselves that everything that happens in history, we believe, is divinely ordained. We call this Hashgacha Paratus. So many people who lived or died based on what would otherwise be called the vagaries of life. You know, famous story, the people who were fired from their work on the previous Friday, got a pink slip and they were so distraught, and that saved their lives. We know individuals who stayed late in shul because it was slichas then. It was a week before Rosh Hashanah, and that saved their lives. We all know stories of this type. This one from my own shul was actually in the building, ran down, and her life was spared. We all know stories. But the critical lesson is to understand that whatever happens is a result of divine providence. And that year, just exactly a week, 1 week precisely, after the event, when I was able to return and serve as a Baal Tefillah in the shul, and we said it in the Sana Tokef, Iva Eish, which we usually go through very quickly, we don't think about Eish these days, or Iva Skila, all of a sudden it took on a whole totally new meaning. Now 10 years later, we dare not forget those who perished, and equally importantly, dare not forget that our lives are in the balance and determined by the Rabbona Shalom himself. May this thought of tshuva be the initial healer to show to those who perished, to hate the shmas of the tzurur of the throne of time.
religious Rosh Yeshiva, my parents, and my in-laws. Being asked to reflect on your personal experience in the wake of this tragedy is a bit peculiar, as I'm sure everyone in this room has vivid memories of where they were when the tragic events of September 11, 2001 unfolded. My experience on that day was probably not extraordinary in any way. I remember that on that Tuesday morning, I was sitting in a class at Stern College on Hillel Brachot, taught by Rabbi Alman. During class, we heard what sounded like entire fleets of fire engines and ambulances racing by our window. As Lexington Avenue traveled southbound, and virtually all of New York City's first responders were rushing to get to the World Trade Center site. Sirens were not an uncommon sound in Midtown Manhattan, but as they persisted, I excused myself from class to go check the nearest computer to see what was going on. It became apparent rather quickly that the world around me was changing before my eyes. For the year prior to 9/11, I had been studying in Israel. I was planning to return for one more semester, but after a summer round of dangerous terror attacks, my parents prevailed upon me not to return. I was supposed to stay here in New York, where it was safe. I did not imagine that during my time in New York City, I would be closer to any terrorist attack than I had ever been before. I knew that the experience would forever change my life. At that time, the notion of change was something that felt synonymous with my stage of life. College for me, as I'm sure it is for many others, was about a transition to adulthood. There are many decisions to be made about your future. Where am I going in life? What career path will I choose? What are the core values I believe in? Who are the people that I will turn to for guidance and support? At that stage, it felt like life for my friends and I was in flux. While the rest of the world outside of Stern was full of people on very certain paths, individuals who get up with purpose, go to work, come home, and ultimately know where they would be going the next day. The terror attacks of 9/11 threw this city and this country into a transitional tailspin much akin to that of a college student needing to make decisions upon which their futures will rely. The country was forced to re-examine its values and decide what would be its direction. No one knew at the time what the next days, weeks, or months would bring. In fact, as I recall, for some good length of time after the attacks, no one even thought that far into the future. We had been very rudely reminded of the fragility of our existence. For individuals on the brink of adulthood, this normal transition phase took on extra meaning, as my generation would now be framing their futures on the backdrop of billowing smoke as it poured out from the smoldering towers. None of us could ever, and would ever, forget the inches of thick debris that coated every surface of Lower Manhattan, nor the stench of what the violence and hatred of others had brought onto our city. This was a catastrophic act of national significance. It would forever alter the collective national narrative of the United States of America. No more than days or hours passed from when the attack took place that reactions and responses began popping up around the city. First, utter shock and disbelief, followed by deep and painful grief and profound fear. And ultimately, the attempt to cope cracked up. Individuals poured into houses of worship in numbers not seen for many years. On street corners and in neighborhoods, people began supporting each other, helping each other and working to rebuild together. The spirit of camaraderie was palpable. From this tragedy and moments of darkness, a great new aura of Arevut was born, a time when people recognized the facets of life we all share rather than those which separate us. One place where this sense of ultimate human care and kindness became clear to me was serving as part of the Shmirat contingent from Stern College on a Friday night that November. I remember walking toward the tent that was stationed near NYU Hospital, where the remains from Ground Zero had been steadily brought in for days and weeks on end. I wondered what the experience would be like. Upon entering the tent, I encountered a number of people from different religious backgrounds. There I was, a young student of only 19 years, tasked with the awesome responsibility of guarding the deceased as their remnants lie in wait to be identified and buried. I remember sitting there thinking to myself about the hundreds of different faces and names I had seen on flyers around the city in the early days. The flyers, indicators of hopefulness from families who were desperate to avoid the grim reality of what had transpired. I remember trying to imagine the world of connections that were attached to each and every one of these individuals, and how the myriad of ties that were cast out from each of them would now be severed. As a young woman who was privileged to have only experienced one or two personal losses of life up to that point in my short history, I was overcome. I sat quietly and recited Tehillim, beginning with Perek Kufiyotet, as I spelled out the word Neshama, reading the appropriate psukim in turn. As it continued my reading, tears began to stream down my face. A middle-aged man who was a pastor saw my tears and approached me. We began talking about our background and what brought us to this tent, and how we were each coping with the tragedy. After some conversation, he gave me a pin that was a picture of angel's wings and said that he would pray for God to watch over me, just as I had taken the task of watching over the deceased at that time. I thought it no coincidence that this was a Friday night, Shabbat, and as he handed me the pin with the picture of angel's wings, the melody of Shalom Aleichem played in my head. Being a young Jewish woman who grew up in an Orthodox environment, I had very little exposure to people of other faiths. That moment in my life was the first time in which I felt I had something deeply in common with someone of another faith. And that was not only going through this tragedy, but more so both deciding that the way to respond was through action. The way to respond was to see how you can help and how you can make a difference, be it ever so minuscule, in the lives of the families and friends of those who were killed on that day. I remember thinking specifically of someone who was a classmate of mine for over 15 years, whose sister was working at Cantor Fitzgerald on that day, and whose remains were ultimately identified only a number of years later. Reflecting about why I was drawn to be part of the Shmirah, I can only think of the other national catastrophe I'm familiar with. In my family, our personal narrative of national significance was the Shoah. Being the granddaughter of four Holocaust survivors, the notion of complete physical obliteration of the people you love is unfortunately not so foreign. During my otherwise loving and happy childhood, I always understood that there was extensive familial loss of lives of people whose exact outcomes would remain forever unknown. People who were terribly missed and whose last moments we will never be able to know and understand. In 2001, the opportunity to provide a shmirah, a spiritual guardianship for the souls of those who suffered at their lives' end, felt like a unique opportunity for me. An opportunity that was denied to the parents, siblings, cousins, aunts, and uncles of each and every one of my grandparents, each of them losing entire worlds of people. The collective narrative of that loss was transmitted from my grandparents. However, it came along with balance and purpose. Memory is essential, but can't be all-encompassing. Their message to my family was always about reacting and compensating by trying to make things better in the world. After that Tuesday that changed my life, and I'm sure many lives have lived here, I instinctively recognized that this was the direction that I needed to go. The events that changed the world that day and made many in this city and this country feel confused, for me provided a sense of great clarity of mission. It helped me understand what role I wanted to pursue. The question now is, where am I and where are we 10 years later? When the tragedies originally occurred, that Tuesday fell between the parshiyot of Ki Tavoh and Nitzavim. Parshat Ki Tavoh speaks of bracha and klala, of blessing and curse, the notion of actions and consequences. The events of 9/11 taught only too violently the results of people's choices. Those who choose to wreak havoc on the world, those who choose to punish innocent people for reasons we can't understand. And in a paradoxical way, it also made us question the concept of consequences, as thousands of innocent lives were lost. The parsha immediately following 9/11 was Nitzavim. Literally, the word means, we are standing. The parsha always falls prior to Rosh Hashanah, a time when we are all standing on the precipice of a new year, and it is in our hands to decide how we are going to act. How do we behave in light of terrible klala, in this case, the devastation of the attack? In the immediate post-9/11 era in New York City, there was a palpable change. As a geographic community, the citizens of this city and our region decided to act differently and to make changes for the better. Much as Parshat Nitzavim gives us a promise of redemption, so too the actions of the people around the city after 9/11 gave me faith in the kindness and humanity of people, a faith that the 19 infamous individuals who perpetrated the attacks tried so hard to undermine. Now, 10 years later, this day of September 11th falls between Ki Teitzei and Ki Tavo. The names of these parshiyot evoke a sense of transition. We are leaving and we are coming. One era is ending and another is beginning. The horrors of that day are beginning to transition into the words that fill the pages of history books. They will be enshrined in the monuments and commemorative park that is being finalized at Ground Zero. And even though the family members, the victims, and all of us will forever mourn, on some level, we as a national and local community are ending the phase of coping with immediate tragedy and entering a new phase of struggling and how to remember this historically. In these parshiyot of Ki Teitzei and Ki Tavo, we see the strongest indications of the importance of memory in Jewish life. These parshiyot contain the retelling of the experiences that shaped us as a nation. In them we read the psukim of Zechirat Amalek, the tragic event of its day, as well as the words of Arami Oved Avi and the retelling of Yitzhak Mitzrayim. These words, Arami Oved Avi, accompany the bringing of Bikurim and are the foundational words of the Pesach Seder, which is the ultimate vehicle for communal memory. The Parsha Ki Tavo can help us understand the importance of communal memory even now in 2011. We remember the klalot, the bad things that befell us as a nation, and our redemption from them. This is an important lesson not only for the Jewish people, but for the concept of a nationhood as a whole. We can only maintain our sense of connection through a shared narrative. At the Pesach Seder, we retell the story of Yitzhak Mitzrayim to maintain the mesorah of connectedness between ourselves, other Jews around the world, and with our Jewish ancestors throughout history, those who experienced the bondage of Egypt and ultimately our exodus from it. The events of 9/11 are now part of our national American narrative. The telling, retelling, and remembering of the events of that day will keep us connected to others who shared in the tragedy, just as the telling of Yitzhak Mitzrayim keeps us connected to our co-religionists around the world and throughout history. For me, one of the most important parts of the Seder, as always demonstrated by my parents, was called Dichven Yeseh V'Yekol. All who are needy should come and eat. The reason we open our homes in this way is because we remember. We remember Avadim Hayinu, that we were enslaved in Egypt, and as a response, we take action to compensate for our terrible experiences and help others through theirs. So too, we open our homes on that day to those less fortunate. The persistence of ritualized memory prevents us from becoming complacent. It reminds us to maintain a sense of arevut. In my view, our challenge moving forward into the new 10 years post-September 11th is to maintain our communal commitment, both as Jews and New Yorkers and members of Klal Yisrael, to the memory of the tragedy and the importance of acting in a way that can help us all recuperate from it. As Jews who have an expertise in communal ritualized memory, we have a responsibility to help make sure that we don't become complacent and instead bring our strong tradition to the events of 9/11. With this, I hope this day each year will recall not only the tragic events that occurred, but also the importance of the chesed and care which it inspired.
Thank our panelists. I think in some ways this is too trivial. But we're going to open up for a few questions. And then we're going to split into three different groups, three different shiurim that we talked about. One is shiur given by Rabbi Reese, on reflections relating to the resolution of the World Trade Center Aguna cases. Then another shiur, which will be given simultaneously by Rabbi Willig, on the halachas of the 9/11 Aguna situation corresponding and the conversations with Gedolim in Israel. And then a third simultaneous shiur that will be given by myself, by me, and that is finding God in times of darkness, going through issues from a philosophical perspective. But before we move to that, we'll just open this for a few questions.
Please. This is addressed to all panelists, but from different perspectives. I know the Rabbanim, I assume, spoke about on Rosh Hashanah, but they spoke about the events of September 11th on Rosh Hashanah. I'm sure Ms. Barber heard wherever she was davening what they spoke about. I'd like to know how what they spoke about then relates to now.
Yeah. Any other questions before we... Yes.
To Rabbi Aris, first of all, your lecture was excellent, and I want to give you shkaya. But the question, the way I heard from your lecture, you were really trying to define what is a siman mufak. That was the whole key to the identification process. Now, my question is, has some of the things or definitions you came up with been accepted? For instance, is now DNA a siman mufak?
Yeah, we're going to take two more questions, and then we're going to have all of them answered in one fell swoop.
Yes, thank you. I really appreciated the elaboration on the careful, meticulous examination of the evidence, high-tech, low-tech, regarding the whereabouts and the situation of the people who are missing. How would that compare to the examination of the evidence after the Holocaust, when there were survivors who were unknown and complex situation at that time?
One final question. Okay.
Thank you. I was not a resident of New York at the time, a resident of Pittsburgh, and I remember reports as the plane was approaching Pittsburgh, and we thought it would ultimately attack Pittsburgh. For the rest of the country who are not so immediately involved in the experience of New Yorkers and having the attachment to the physical geographical location, what would be the general lesson that we can spread so that perhaps others would feel more attached?
I'll focus my response on the second and third questions primarily. With respect to the DNA evidence, there was a responsum by a well-respected posek in Eretz Yisrael by the name of Shmuel Bosner. Bosner was approached by Dr. Jay Levinson, who's a forensic expert in Israel, who actually worked closely with the Israeli military, the Israeli police, whenever there were identification issues relating to terrorist attacks in Israel. And they also had to deal with these types of questions. And he actually had approached Rav Bosner even before the tragedy of 9/11. And Rav Bosner, in a published responsum, ruled that DNA evidence could be relied upon as what he referred to as karov, the siman mufak, meaning that it was not exactly a siman mufak because presumably it differs in certain respects from classical forms of ironclad identification, but it was very close to having that status. And therefore, in any case in which there was a DNA identification combined with other very strong and compelling circumstantial evidence of death, which standing alone would not have been sufficient, once that evidence would be combined with DNA identification, that could be relied upon. He also drew a distinction between DNA identification that would be made based on the remains of the missing person himself, and another type of DNA identification, which is called identification through kinship analysis, where instead of the identification being made based on the actual DNA of the missing person, in cases where such samples, for example, might not be available, then they would take samples from the person's parents. And based on the DNA of the parents, they would be able to make a comparison with the remains that would be found. That, he felt, was of a somewhat lesser status. However, based upon all of the analysis and investigation and inquiry that followed after the tragedy of 9/11, it seems that the preponderance of the poskim who really examined the current methodologies of DNA identification no longer focused as much on a distinction between identification of the person and kinship analysis, first of all, because both of them are pretty strong when done with careful professionalism and integrity. And secondly, based on different arguments that we do find precedents in halakhic literature, that when there is a margin of error in an identification of less than 1 in 1,000, certainly when it's generally less than 1 in 1 billion and 1 in 1 trillion, it was more of a readiness to consider the possibility of DNA serving alone as a siman mufak, as a standalone ironclad form of identification. But again, in terms of the actual cases, both in terms of the cases resolved by the Beit Din of America that involved DNA identification, and the case of the Lakewood Beit Din, which also relied in part on DNA identification, it was never necessary in any of the actual cases that were resolved to go beyond the ruling of Rav Shmuel Bozner, because there was always strong circumstantial evidence in addition to the DNA evidence that was found. With respect to the Holocaust, the question with the Holocaust also was that you had just a colossal tragedy that affected an entire continent of people, unprecedented in so many different ways throughout the course of Jewish history. And whenever there's a probability of death, this is what falls into the category that the Talmud describes as Mayim She'ein Lahem Sof, a person who falls into water that doesn't have clear boundaries. Maybe the person emerged in a place where the onlooker can't see. So you only have a probability of death, which cannot be relied upon according to halakha standing alone, and not a near certainty of death. However, Rav Moshe Feinstein, a famous response, I mean, this is just one approach to the Holocaust cases. It's obviously a much lengthier discussion. But Rav Moshe Feinstein said that whenever you have a tragedy that affects not just one person, but an entire continent, and you have a probability of death established because someone saw the person, for example, in a death camp, so Moshe Feinstein said that the Gemara was never talking about that type of a case. Whenever it affects such a giant population of people, one would be able to rely upon that form of evidence in terms of declaring death and enabling the widow to remarry.
I will try to address the first question, since I'm probably amongst the three, the only one who was giving a drasha that Rosh Hashanah. If I recall correctly, I was quoting from the shiur that I heard from Rabbi Shapiro, Shalita in Yerushalayim. It's focused on the Perek of Yeshaya, the second Perek of the Navi Yeshaya. It's a rather famous passage. It begins with a very famous pasuk, Beis Yaakov, Yehudel Chavor Hashem. But some sukkim later, it discusses much more on point references. I read from again Yeshayahu Perek Beis Pasuk Tetzvav, V'al Kol Migdol Gavoa, on every high tower, every high tower, V'al Kol Anios Tarshish, on all the boats of trade, as the Radak explains. So we have here incredibly in the Navi Yeshayahu, written a long time ago, prophesying, as Rashi says, towards the end of days, reference to high towers and references to trade centers. And what is the lesson to be learned from all of this? Some critical lessons. The first lesson is that we as believing Jews have to think differently than the rest of the world. Indeed, we know Beis Yaakov, right, is criticized Why? Ki natashta amcha beis Yaakov. What does that mean? You're no longer thinking the way you should be thinking. To quote the Mitzudos, it says as follows. You're thinking etzos philosophios ve'enem choshishim le'machshevetz ha'torah v'atzasa. Now Shapiro was explaining that we as Jews, survivors, if you will, all of the terror, have to think Torah way of thought, not the general philosophy of the nations of the world. And what, in fact, is the Torah way of thought in describing these events? So, to make a long story very short, twice the pasuk says, "V'niska v'Hashem levado v'yom ahu," that Hashem alone will be exalted on that day. And alone means to the exclusion of all humankind. It means all individuals who have climbed into the high towers, who are successful in their international trade, they will all be brought down. Each and every one of them will be brought down to recognize and realize. Ayishach Adam Vayish Palish. Every person comes down in the recognition that his or her life is totally dependent on the Kaddish Baruch. This is the lesson of the destruction of 9/11 for each and every one of us. It was as true now as it was true then.
To be honest, I don't recall exactly what the drasha was 10 years ago on Shulchan Rosh Hashanah. But I think that my reflections then during the tefillah, as Rabbi Willig alluded to about Mitana Tokia, that feeling of Mibaish, Mibamaya, Mibacherem was extremely profound at that moment because it was so real and so raw. And I think now, 10 years later, it's sometimes difficult to get back to that place where we really, where I at least really connect so personally to the individuals and that moment. And for me, what I feel the lesson is now, 10 years later, is to sort of be able to maintain that kind of personal, emotional, deep connection, because that's ultimately, I believe, what keeps us connected in doing the right thing, in doing our actions, and remembering that our lives are in the hands of our Kadosh Baruch Hu. And I think if we can maintain the closeness and the distance at the same time, finding that balance is often difficult, and we oscillate between them. But for me, Rosh Hashanah is a time to try and find that space.
I want to first begin by thanking our panelists for really speaking from the heart. And we were all touched by the conversations and by your Torah. Thank you very much. I want to thank our partners that helped put this Kol Midrash Yom Rishon together, the Beis Din of America, Rabbi Shlomo Weissman and Mr. Eric Goldstein, for being partners with Yeshiva University, with Rabbi Yeshivas Rabbi Eliezer Zuchanan in a host of different ways. We greatly appreciate the partnership, and we look forward to discussing more joyous issues and our responsibilities to develop the Torah and its practical ramifications on our people and society. The Shiurim will take place in the following breakout rooms. We actually had to change them because when we thought with all the different shuls having various types of memorial services and some of the security challenges, we were afraid that people would stay away from this morning, and we planned accordingly. So we thank God we'll now replan. And so towards that end, we're going to do the following. Rabbi Willig's shiur, the halachas of 9/11, the conversations with Gadol and Eretz Yisrael will take place on the fourth floor of this building, room 430. Now, just in case you forget that from here to the elevator, there will be somebody by the elevator if you have one of those moments, which I'm starting to resonate with. So there will be somebody by the elevator that will remind you that Rabbi Willig Shear is in room 430. Rabbi Willig, if you forget where it is, there's somebody there. Rabbi Reese's Shear will be in room 218. would still be somebody there also, but 218. And since I know I will definitely forget, my share will actually be in here. One more thing. There was a very important sefer that was put out. I actually had the opportunity to read half of it in the past 2 weeks. Contending with Catastrophe, Jewish Perspectives on September 11th. The editor is Michael Broyd, and I would be remiss if I didn't indicate that Menachem Butler did a tremendous amount of work in making sure this happens. It is a wonderful sefer dealing with both the halachic and philosophical issues. It will be available for purchase after the shiur in the back of this room. And again, I ask everyone right now to please move to the various locations. Again, Rabbi Willick in 430, Rabbi Reese in room 218, and my shiur will take place right here. Okay.